Amen.
Yes. Did I say chapter 27?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I meant chapter 26. Started to panic there because my notes did not say chapter 27. Chapter 26. Alright, so chapter 26 really begins the final events of Jesus on earth, right? And really the whole point of Jesus being on earth in the first place, right? This is the culmination of God's plan for man really since the beginning of creation, right? And in fact, Nathan's lessons have been kind of are centered around that as well, especially for today's lesson. And you know, this is the culmination since really the beginning of creation. And so at minimum, you know, this had been, you know, 4,000 years in the making. And all scripture written before Matthew in the Gospels has been pointing forward to this event. And all scripture written after the Gospels has been looking back toward these events. And the importance and gravity of what takes place in these next few chapters, right, can probably never be overstated. You know, this is the centerpiece of God's working for his creation. Because without these events, right, I would have no hope in this life of the one to come, and you would have no hope in this life. You know, the world would still be lost in sin and condemned to be separated from God for all eternity. And so keep that in mind as we go through these final chapters. Ben mentions in the handouts, you know, it would be highly rewarding if you took a moment, you know, at some point to go back and read what the other Gospels have to say around these events, starting from the triumphal entry through the resurrection and even into Acts chapter 1 for the ascension, right? Because they each offer something unique, and they each give you a different piece of the picture to see sort of as a whole what transpired and what took place in these final days. But in Matthew especially, we're going to see that despite everything going on, Jesus is in command. Right, Jesus is the one giving the orders. Jesus is the one controlling the events taking place. Right, here is the Messiah who knows what is going to happen, and even in a way is speaking that into effect. And Matthew wants to be sure that we see the hand of God in all of this. Right, he's not simply narrating what some evil people did to a good and compassionate man. Right, and we're going to see that actually right away. And so let's go ahead and let's read verses 1 through 5 of chapter 26. TJ, if you could read that for us, please.
When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people."
Alright, so now, you know, so we notice that the chief priests and the elders are now, you know, are plotting to kill Jesus, but their plan was to wait till after the festival, or after the feast, right? Because they didn't want to cause a riot with, you know, with amongst the crowds. Now, what seems wrong with that plan?
Well, if it were legal for them to take him, if there were any justification for it, there's no justification for waiting.
Okay.
I mean, that's one of the things wrong with it. They also know that the people will be incensed because they've been following him.
So that's one thing.
So, I mean, there, all the political aspects of it are there, that they're not concerned about God's will, they're concerned about theirs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What else? Nathan, your hand up.
It's kind of along the same lines, but if it was the right thing to do, you could do it in the light. If it's the wrong thing to do, you have to do it in the darkness. And so they're kind of condemning themselves by admitting they need to sort of conceal this as much as they can.
Right. You know, another thing that's wrong with this is probably their dates, right? Their own timing and their own plan. So the morality of this, aside, Jesus actually has other plans. And he actually gives his fourth prediction of the crucifixion to his disciples, but here he adds one new element. What's that new element? Which is?
In 2 days,
right? So the chief priests and the elders are probably thinking like 2 weeks, right? And then we'll do this. But Jesus is like, no, in 2 days, right? This is actually the start of Passover. And so, what does this tell us? Again, it tells us that Jesus is not some helpless victim, right? He is the one deciding the date of when they are going to crucify him. Again, it's emphasizing, again, he knows what awaits him, and he's submitting to it willingly, right? And even making sure that it's going to happen. Other comments or questions? All right, so now we're going to see a story inside of a story, right? So sort of meanwhile, in verses 6 through 13. Michael, if you could read that.
Now when Jesus was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster vial of very costly perfume, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. The disciples were indignant when they saw this and said, "Why this waste? For this perfume might have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor." But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you bother the woman? For she has done a good deed to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. For when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, whatever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken in memory of her."
So Matthew here is organizing by theme, and not so much in chronological order, because we learn in John that this event actually takes place the Saturday, the preceding Saturday, which I believe the events we just read would have been Wednesday, with two days until Friday, and so this is actually more by theme. But he's doing this because he wants to contrast here what Mary does versus what we're going to see Judas do here in just a moment, right? And so this is Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And, she's showing how extravagant her love for Jesus is by pouring this whole bottle of perfume or oil right on Jesus. And again, there's more details in John. And the disciples don't seem too happy about that, right? And again, in John 12, I believe it sort of calls out Judas especially. And Judas is the one that sort of makes this comment. But either way, Jesus rebukes the disciples for their objection, and he views Mary's act as really this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to demonstrate a very special kind of sacrificial love, right? And in fact, she creates sort of this object lesson for all those who are witnessing, and Jesus even says, right, for all those who will be reading, and he points out this symbolism in her anointing him as preparation for burial. And he says, there will always be opportunities to help the poor, right? But this may be and will be the last opportunity for Mary to minister to Jesus before his death. Okay, so comments or questions on that before we go to this next section? Yes, sir.
Are we sure? Do we know that this was Mary?
Yes. In John 12, it says he was at Lazarus' house.
But in John 12, it says that she anointed his feet and wiped it with her hair.
Yeah.
This one says that the woman anointed his head.
You're right. Well, it says she pours the whole bottle, so I'd imagine it's more than just his head, but you're right. I did notice that as well.
This was a sealed bottle. Once it was broken, it couldn't be resealed. So they would use the whole bottle.
Right.
This was very expensive. I don't know. I can't say for sure it was Mary. I do believe it is. But also, this is the house of Simon the leper. It was unlawful for them to abide with the leper. But this is one that Jesus would have healed. Jesus had no problem going to eat supper with him.
Yeah, and that's also, so it could have been that Simon was a former leper, right, that Jesus had healed him previously, or it could just been, again, breaking sort of going against the norm and still dining with this individual as well. So that also has some questions. Nathan?
I was going to say, Mary's approach to Jesus is an approach we ought to take ourselves. A very common piece of advice that we sometimes will give to people is, you know, you need a good balance in your life. You know, we often talk about balance. Mary was not having a very balanced approach to her devotion to Jesus. It was an extreme approach. And so, you know, there may be appropriate aspects of her life, but the idea of balance might be good advice. But when it comes to our service to Jesus, you got to give it your all.
Yeah.
There's really no such thing as a good approach to Jesus that is balanced.
Good point.
But the commentaries are split on whether it's Mary, Mary and Martha, or Mary Magdalene. But for sure, it would be a good woman.
Right. Yeah, and there's certainly a lot of Marys, right, that are discussed. And so, to your point, Mike, you know, it could be a different Mary. I think often would I people kind of even towards Mary, sister of Martha and Lazarus, but I wouldn't be willing to bet on that.
I don't even know if it was a Mary. It says a woman.
John.
Yeah.
Yeah, the quotes, the Jesus' words are very similar.
Yeah.
Were important.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and Matthew, you know, Matthew very often leaves out. You know, he's not the detailed, you know, person. He often summarizes a lot of these events and really gets to the point rather than the specifics, right? So the lesson here is really what the actions of this woman or Mary doing, right? Knowing that this is really anointing him for burial.
The emphasis should be on the actions rather than the
right. And then in 14 and 16, so it reads, so then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to betray him to you?" And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him. And from then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray Jesus. So what's Judas's deal here?
Greedy?
Could he have any other motives?
Well, I don't know. It seems that he has some evil motive. I don't know if he just hates Jesus or if he's, you know, doesn't plainly state that, you know, he has hatred for him, but I don't know. It's kind of hard to pinpoint his motive for betraying Jesus, other than greed.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, I think he wanted the money because he could have done it for free. Right? He could have betrayed Jesus for free. Karen?
It sounds like that this story was put in here in the order that you said, so that it makes it look like he was mad at being called out by Jesus.
That he was, yeah, it very well, yeah, there's definitely a contrasting picture here, right, of Martha, sort of, no, sorry, Mary, you know, giving, you know, to Jesus and Judas sort of wanting to take, right, to have that greed. Because he goes up, right, and he says, "What are you willing to give me to betray him," right? And it's sort of sad because he offers really not that much money, considering, you know, what it is he's really doing. Now, I don't know if he really understands the implications, right, you know, of what they intend to do with him. And maybe we'll see that a little bit later. Yes, sir?
I don't think that he ever accepted that Jesus was a Messiah. To him, it was just maybe a prophet. Like,
right.
And so it was very, you know, every time we have a reference to Judas, it's not a good one. And, you know, we ask, or at least I ask myself, you know, why did God choose him? And the answer is, you know, even though he knew his heart, there was always the opportunity to try to turn him around.
Yeah, good point. And that could be another reason, right? You know, a lot of people by this point are sort of disappointed in Jesus because he's not living up to these preconceived notions that they had of the Messiah, right? Jesus isn't, right. He's entered the city, and what is he doing? He's not. Why isn't he, leading the charge to overthrow the Romans? Yes, ma'am.
It's clear throughout all the accounts that Judas has a very worldly point of view. And Jesus is, to be fair, always fussing at all the disciples for that and trying to get their point of view changed to see things from God's point of view. And I'm not convinced that Judas knew what was going to happen.
Right.
He may have thought Jesus could have gotten out of it, that he can profit out of it and nothing bad's going to happen. I think when he sees what actually happens, that is a huge blow to him, and that's why he ends up committing suicide.
Right.
But the point is that he has a very worldly view and he never changes it.
I think that's where I lean as well. I don't think he understands, the severity of the actions until afterward, right? And that's when he tries to go and get back the money. And we'll get to that, I believe, later this chapter. Or is that next chapter? Yes?
I was just wondering if he would have gone through it if the high priest would have said, well, we offer you nothing. I mean...
Would he have done it for free?
Yeah. I just wonder that, sometimes
right. When
I read that, and we offer you nothing, would he still do it, or would he just back down and just figure out another way?
Right. Yes, ma'am?
I was thinking an answer to Robert's question as to why did God choose him. God had a plan, and Judas was part of that plan, whether he was offered the money or not offered the money. He was going to be used as a means to have his son sacrificed for our sins.
Michael?
I don't know. I'm not sure that he would have. What we know about him seems to say that he probably wouldn't have. But there was a plan that needed to be fulfilled in the coming weeks.
Coming days.
the prophecy and 30 pieces of silver was already prophesied as well. So there was a plan set in motion. Whether or not they offered him money is at this point, I think, just hearsay.
Can't a lot of hands, Mark, and then we'll go over here. My peripheral's not that wide.
Judas was on the went out and did many miracles. Healing the sick and driving out evil spirits just as well as John did. Then you read the account of John. Judas had a problem. He liked money. Judas was not asked by the high priest. Judas went on his own.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when you go back and read the accounts of the Last Supper, Jesus gave Judas about 4 chances to change. We just studied the parables of the unprofitable servant. This is Judas. He's unprofitable. He is not with them. We have it, sadly, most likely in this church as well. They show up, but their heart's not with us. I hope it's not true, but if it's in the world, I've learned it's usually in the church.
Last comment, and then for the sake of time, we'll move forward.
I was just going to say, Luke 22:3 might be a good answer as to what was Judas' motivation besides greed. It says that Satan entered him.
And Satan was able to enter him, right? Because he still had that very worldly mindset. The son of perdition. All right. All great comments. Let's go ahead and let's continue on. And Mark mentioned the Last Supper, and so now we're going to get to that. Mark, if you could read 17 through 23, and then TJ, if you could read 24 through 30.
Verse 17. Now on the first day of the unleavened bread. the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says my time is near, and I am to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.' Then the disciples said, did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. Now when evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12 disciples. And as they were eating, he said, 'Truly I say to you that one of you will betray me.' Being deeply grieved, they each one began to say, 'Surely not I, Lord.' And he answered, 'He who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. The Son of Man is to—'"
Yeah, so TJ, you can pick up there.
"The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him, but woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." Then Judas, the one who would betray him, said, "Surely not I, Rabbi." Jesus answered, "Yes, it is you." While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to the disciples, saying, "Take and eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and offered it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives.
So these events are well known for us, right? But again, we see that Jesus pretty much has all things in order, right? He goes, he tells them to go into the city to a certain man. Here's what you say. Here's what you should do, right? He's planned all of this out. And so evening comes, and they're eating this meal together, and now Jesus drops the bombshell on them, right? "One of you will betray me." Now, we know what this betrayal meant. I can only wonder, right, what they maybe thought that it meant. But we have their initial reaction, right? And their initial reaction was, "Surely not I." And I can't help but sort of dwell on, you know, maybe, you know, focusing on what they don't say or what they don't do, right? And that is, they don't start pointing fingers at the one who they thought might be the most likely to betray Jesus, right? You know, even if we don't voice it, I imagine we usually sort of go through our own minds, you know, I wonder who's the most likely of us to do something like that, right? And say they don't, you know, and so the fact that they don't all just point to Judas and say, you know, Judas is going to be the one to betray him, you know, maybe might tell us that he probably hasn't really even made it evidence that he would do something like this, right? You know, maybe, you know, he hasn't given any sort of warning signs or red flags, at least for the other disciples, to make them think that he might be the one. Did you have a hand up?
Yes. You know, one of the things that Jesus did a lot was chastise his disciples for not having enough faith. And I think, you know, when they're asking, is it me? I think that's a sincere question that they have, because they know what they've been through, they know what questions they've had, and they probably remember what Jesus has told them about not having enough faith.
Right. And, you know, and what's more interesting, you know, is that, you know, even Judas, you know, asks, and I assume maybe he's sort of trying to keep up appearances here, right? And so even he says, you know, "Surely not I." And you know, TJ's, I believe, version said, you know, "Yes, you are the one." Mine's a little bit more indirect, says, "You have said it yourself." You know, I think both probably are the same meaning. But what's interesting about that, do you think? At least something stands out to me when Jesus makes this comment to Judas. John?
He doesn't seem to understand that Jesus sees into him.
Yeah, or even
he's still trying to hide it from Jesus.
Or even the other disciples, you know, when they hear that, you know, at least we're not told of any reaction. You know, what must be going through their minds, and it sort of just passes over all of their heads. Yes, sir.
When I listen to this, well, for one thing, you know the prophecy has to be fulfilled in order for things to come together. We know that. But I wonder, when Jesus says, it is as you say, that you're going to betray me, why didn't the other disciples jump on him?
Right.
And say, oh, no, you're not, you know, and capture him and put him away or something like that. I mean, it just stuns me that they all sat there and did nothing.
Right.
You know. But you know, Jesus is not going to lie, so they would have been in their rights to apprehend him and say, no, you're not. You know, but I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely a distinct sort of lack of commentary on what the other disciples are thinking or doing or
well, if they even really
understood.
Understood.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I think what Jesus has said has shocked them all.
That's true.
That one of us.
Right.
I think they're still trying to process that information.
But they go show the love they have to Jews.
Yeah, but at the same time, when they were thinking, it is not I mean, he came right out and said it is Judas, you know.
And there's okay, more, right? And
everybody else, so you'd have thought that they would, Simon, really? So let's capture this guy, you know. I don't know.
And they don't believe he's going to die.
That's true. That's also true, right? And this is only the beginning, right? Because you know, and even more, you know, Judas just sort of gets up in the middle of all this and you know goes through with it. But we're going to see here in a moment that he's going to return with this mob, and still we sort of have a lack of discussion on the disciples' reaction toward Judas and all of this. But let's press on, right? And of course, and so now we have the instituting of the Lord's Supper, and we have all kinds of symbolism wrapped up right in this final meal. The breaking of the bread foreshadows his body, right, figuratively broken and literally killed, his upcoming death. And then we have the cup, which stands for the blood that was about to be shed and his death on the cross. And I know we have many lessons. Every Lord's Day, we have talks on this. And so for the sake of time, we'll go ahead and move on. And if there's any questions or discussion, we can definitely address it after class. But let's go ahead and move on to verses 31 through 35. Cameron, if you could read that for us.
What verses?
31 through 35.
Sure. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." But Peter said to him, "Even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, that this very night, before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." All the disciples said the same thing too.
So Jesus pretty much outlines everything remaining in the rest of this gospel, right? The disciples would abandon him. Peter would deny him, that he would be killed, which is sort of in the striking down of the shepherd, and then he would be raised up again, right? And not only that, after he was raised up, he would meet the disciples in Galilee, right? So, you know, if you think about that, you know, I don't know how many of you intend to make any appointments after you die to meet someone somewhere, right? Or if anyone's ever tried to make an appointment with you to meet you, you know, somewhere after they die, and likely you aren't going to believe them. But he tells them at the beginning of the chapter, hey, in 2 days, I'm going to be crucified. And then after that, I'll meet you in Galilee, right? And so again, they sort of just still don't get it. And in all fairness, I don't think we would have gotten it either if we were in their shoes. But what do you think about Peter's attitude in all of this?
Very
typical. You know, he proves more impulsive than truthful. And in fact, you know, Jesus replies, you know, Peter will probably be even more disloyal than the other 10 by denying even knowing Jesus three times, and then even swearing an oath on that fact.
You know, maybe earlier when Peter said, "Among with the other 12, surely not I," maybe that just shows there's more uncertainty than humility.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think Peter's being untruthful here. I mean, he was ready to defend Jesus in the garden. I think he was feeling that brave. He was feeling that, I don't know, he was going to do this. I think it was after he got beat in the garden for standing up to Jesus that that's a crisis in his conscience. What was I supposed to do?
Right. It's almost like, okay, you told me I was going to fall away, and I told you I wasn't, so now I'm going to show you. Now you're telling me not to do the thing that you told me I was going to do. Yeah, I can imagine it's all very confusing for Peter.
But Jesus did tell Peter to go to Galilee, and I'll meet you there.
Yeah.
You know, and so Peter had been duly instructed for what to do when his arrest took place.
Sure. Bud?
Well, for me, I know Robert, in a military sense, we can say what we're going to do, but when faced with danger or uncertain consequences, it's human nature to back away from what you say when put in your back against the wall. I really believe that these men meant what they said, but then faced with reality, I think that the situation got the better of them,
right?
And they had to back down.
Yeah.
Reread verse 35. It says, Peter said, "Even if I can die with you, I will not deny you." All the disciples said the same thing also. They all said it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just Peter. They were there as a band of brothers together. Peter gets a bad rap a lot of times, but they jumped in there too.
Oh yeah, for sure. And Peter is often called out, right? Because he goes maybe a little bit farther. I think he definitely crosses a line. I think when he swears an oath to not even.
Don said he read it.
Right.
And that aspect of Peter's personality was useful to the Lord, so that it's not that was a bad personality trait. He just needed to be careful how he used it.
Yeah, and previous lessons, right? I say Peter has a very confrontational style because he's very quick to speak, and we see the strengths of that in Acts chapter 2, right? And really in the start of Acts when he goes and he speaks boldly to the Jews there, for sure. Verses 36 through 46, we have, again, another familiar scene of Jesus praying in the garden, of him being extremely grieved, and, grieved, I'm sure, in the sense of the physical pain that would come, but maybe more so of the spiritual agony that would come of bearing the sins of the world. I imagine that is probably what is grieving him the most. And so when he talks about drinking this cup, I think he's talking about the cup of wrath that he drinks because of bearing man's sins, which would be far worse for him than any physical pain. Though, of course, that too would be horrible. And then he comes back after praying to find his inner three, sleeping. If you were to put yourself in Jesus' shoes and you're in this really period of grief and you find your friends closest to you sleeping, you can imagine how that might make you feel. But I think, more so is they are just not going to be prepared for what's about to happen, right? They have not spent the time really preparing themselves mentally and spiritually. But then eventually after this, Jesus finally says, it's time, come on, let's go, right? The time is now. And so again, notice that this isn't a situation where they tracked Jesus down. He's going to meet them, and he's actually going to help them out and sort of push this process along, right? And so that brings us to verse 47. And Roy, if you could read 47 through 56, please.
Through 56?
Yes, sir.
While he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a large crowd with swords and clubs, who came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he was betraying him. He who was betraying him gave them a sign, saying, "Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him." Immediately Judas went to Jesus and said, "Hail, Rabbi," and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you have come for." Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? How then will the scripture be fulfilled, which say that it must happen this way?" At that time Jesus said to the crowds, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as you would against a robber? Every day I used to sit at the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place to fulfill the scriptures of the prophets." Then all the disciples left him and fled.
We already know the story, you know, and so maybe it doesn't surprise us as much, but, you know, if you were reading for the first time, you know, would it surprise you that there are just so many people that have come to arrest Jesus, right? This angry mob. Why do you think that is? Why all of these people? Could be.
Well, they made him out to. They're in the process of making him out to be insurrectionists. So this is how you would take someone who was potentially mounting a revolt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other thoughts?
Strength in numbers.
You know, almost. You know, I can imagine they probably know what they're doing is a little shady. You know, coming in the middle of the night. You know, so maybe it could be, you know, crime. Crime likes some company. You know, everyone else is doing it. Maybe it doesn't seem so bad. You know, Jesus has also been pretty elusive in the past, right? And so maybe that could be another way. But again, you know, I sort of kind of think back to what are the other 11 thinking, you know, when they see this mob? You know, they have clubs and they have swords. And not only that, but then they see Judas sort of at the head of the mob. You know, has it registered for them yet? I just don't know, again, because we're not really told of their reaction toward him, but really just maybe this deer in the headlights look, except for Matthew just says one who was with Jesus. Again, elsewhere we know that was Peter. And again, I'm wondering why Peter had a sword to begin with. I don't know, is that something he always carried around with him? So that in and itself is kind of stands out to me as well. Other thoughts on this scene?
Well, I wonder why, you know, if they were constantly plotted against Jesus, why did Judas feel the need to have to identify them by kissing him?
And such a very familiar, and, you know, in this, you know, for us, it, you know, might be like a hug, right? We give this great big warm hug, and that's sort of the sign for everyone to come and get him. And so you can imagine, again, just what a you know, stab in the back for sure.
I don't know. The picture that's painted here for me is that this mob, obviously, I don't think they knew exactly what they were doing. It says they come from the chief priests and the elders, right? So the chief priests and the elders are the only ones who are really conspiring against him. You have the Pharisees and the chief priests and the high priest conspiring to get him. And then this mob comes from them. And they have to be shown who Jesus is. Or at least that's how I take from it. So it almost seems like they were whipped up by the chief priests.
Right. Yes, sir.
It's late at night, and it's only being lit by torches. So, I guess the moon, you know. But I think that's also just to ensure there's no mistake that's made.
And if I recall correctly, again, it's not Matthew, but there's, you know, they're even a little hesitant to, you know, to even arrest Jesus. You know, who are you looking for? And we're looking, you know, for Jesus. Well, I am Eve. Come and get me, right? And they're even just a little scared to approach him to begin with. And so again, he's sort of trying to urge him to move this along.
Well, if you're wondering why they're carrying a sword, if you look over in the parallel account of Luke 22, this is where Jesus is saying, "I sent you out without a money belt and a bag and sandals. You didn't lack anything, right? Well, now this time, take a money belt, also take a bag, and whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one."
Oh.
So they're told to actually get a sword now because they know that they're going, they're going to be, in this commission, being sent farther out. Now, there's some differences in the gospel accounts of the ordering of these events, right? Matthew puts them in a different order than Luke in some cases. But here in Luke, remember, Luke is telling this to Theophilus, so Luke's ordering may be a little bit different as well. But they're told specifically, go get a sword.
Good to know. Thank
you. That's actually, that's Luke 22, beginning in, you can call it 35.
Thank you.
Good to know.
Yeah, did not remember that.
And they're not necessarily told to go use that sword.
Right.
But if you happen to have a sword with you, that may
deter. Probably deter.
Causing you to reconsider.
Nathan.
At the end of that, what Nick just referenced in verse 38, they say, well, we have two swords, and Jesus says it is enough.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. We have a few minutes left, so let's go ahead and let's read 57 through 68. Nathan, if you could read that for us.
Those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and entered in, and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now the chief priest and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus, so that they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on two came forward and said, "This man stated, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" The high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." Jesus said to him, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." And the high priest tore his robes. "He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered, "He deserves death." Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fist, and others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, you Christ, who is the one who hit you?"
All right, so right away we can see that something is probably amiss here, right? And there are quite a few things that are maybe, I'll use the word shady. They hold this trial in the middle of the night. They really give Jesus no opportunity for legal representation. They can't even get their witnesses to testify about the same charges. And they convict him immediately with no chance really for acquittal or for appeal. And furthermore, they sort of convict him of these false charges. And they really make no pretense of objectivity, right? They're bent on convicting Jesus of a capital offense. And if that requires them to use false witnesses and false evidence, then so be it, right? And so, of course, for all of this, Jesus remains silent. If his witnesses couldn't agree on exactly what wrongs he had done, there's really no need for him to defend himself to begin with. Eventually, he does say it is as you say, right? Sort of the same thing he told Judas. And so in the eyes of the council, Jesus has just equated himself with God, or at least associated himself much too closely with God. And so they say, well, this is a capital offense. And so the proceedings need not continue any longer. Of course, it's true, but the elders and the chief priests don't see it as such, and Jesus knows what needs to happen. And so he's done defending himself. And he'll remain quiet. Go back, and if you want to, you can read the verses, the passages that we skipped over. So specifically the Garden of Gethsemane, 36 through 46, and then we can read about Peter's three denials. Again, I think we are familiar with a lot of these, and so we'll go ahead and pick up in chapter 27 on Wednesday.
But this is all orchestrated. Go back to verses 2 and 3. The chief priests and the elders were gathered together in the court in verse 4. They plotted together. That's 2 days before.
Mm-hmm.
They knew exactly who Jesus was. They knew exactly where they were going to go.
But they weren't planning on this for another couple of weeks, right? It wasn't until Judas came that they said, oh, we should do something now. Yeah, which is why I think maybe their witnesses didn't quite have their act together, right? They didn't have time to get their story straight.
And yeah, lesson one for Timothy study.